Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.
Welcome to Friends with Money. I'm your host and managing editor of Money Magazine, Julia Newbold. Recently, I had the pleasure of talking to an Australian icon and very unique character for one of our Money Hot Seat interviews. Entrepreneur, philanthropist, patriot, and all-round top bloke, Dick Smith, became a household name not only for his success as a businessman, but for his amazing aviation adventures and unwavering positivity about Australia itself. During the COVID lockdown, he's used his time wisely to finish writing My Adventurous Life, a memoir of inspiring stories and challenges, which he shares with us now. Dick, what have you been doing during lockdown?
I've been pretty well locked up at our house on the northern Sydney suburb of Terry Hills. And I, in fact, the reason for my book is lockdown last year. I got locked up for, 8 or 9 weeks, whatever it was. And that's what got me to finalise my book. It's something I've been meaning to do for decades. And being locked up in the house meant I can sit down and get onto the keyboard and work on the book. This particular lockdown, I've been doing a lot of reading. I'm very interested in aviation books, and I've been picking up books of 100 years ago. And so that was in the 1920s, the early aviators, and learning just how primitive it was then.
Yes, I've read a couple of things recently about the women who were flying the planes during the war to take the soldiers and the personnel around England.
Yeah, the ferry service, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Very risky. I mean, the reason I'm alive is because I've done it 5 flights around the world, and 1 to the North Pole and 2 balloon flights, and I owe my life to, I say, North American technology. The reliability of aircraft is just so fantastic these days, whereas in the 1920s, that was the very early days, and the biggest cause of fatalities was not so much pilot error, it was the mechanical, the aircraft breaking down in some way.
It's good to hear you say that, because I'm not a very good flyer. I get very nervous.
Right. Well, it's very safe now.
So what made you want to write the book in the first place?
So many people said to me, Dick, you know, you've had an interesting life. You've got to put it down in writing. And I thought, oh, that's probably a good idea. I think it's a bit of an ego thing. And also, the main prime reason, I wanted something for my grandchildren to know how Pip and I, my wife and I, started off with so little, but we were able to do quite well. And there's a message in the book that even if you're the most hopeless person at school and you're a bit of a misfit, you can still do okay in this country of Australia. It's a fantastic country.
And obviously you are a very proud Australian, and I remember, you know, you bringing out the Vegemite, you know, to make it still Australian and so on. So
right.
Has that always been a driving passion of yours, to promote the country and promote what we have?
Yes. Look, in the book I mentioned when I was 5 or 6 years of age at school, we'd salute our flag, I honour my God, and I forgot what the wording is now, it's in the book, but we had the Australian flag there, and we actually sung in the 1950s, God Save the King, it was. And so I've always been what you'd call a patriot. I've done well in this country. I won the lottery of life by being born in the 1940s, and growing up since then, we've had wonderful security, and I think we've been well led. And it's allowed someone who's as hopeless as Dick Smith to do okay.
And do you feel that, I guess, you know, you said the word patriot, and it's become a bit tarnished as an idea at the moment. Do you feel that we need to go back, or that it just is a misnomer? Or
yes, well, no, I don't see it tarnished in any way. I realise that there are extreme people on either end of the spectrum. But no, I still think being a patriot, the Governor General gave a quote on the back cover of my book saying I'm a true patriot, and I was very proud that he said that.
And what would you like your legacy to be?
Oh, gee, that's something I haven't thought of. Let me think. My legacy. I think an example to my children, my two girls and my grandchildren, that you can work hard and you can be honest and pay your taxes and still do okay. All of those three things. My parents were very kind people. My dad was a kind person, and I'm hoping that when after I've gone, people will describe me as a kind person. I think that's a nice word.
And what about the things that you've achieved in your life? What would you like to be remembered for there?
Well, the proudest thing that I have in business-wise is really Australian Geographic magazine, which is still going and booming, and that was a very positive magazine. I'd been told when I started it up, my aim was to have a biased magazine that was biased towards the positive and wrote positive things about Australia. And someone said, oh, Dick, you know, positive news never sells. You know, you've got to have the harum scarum things going wrong. But I managed to prove them wrong, and Australian Geographic did very well. I'm proud that every year they have the Australian Geographic Gala Awards Night, where they present the Adventure of the Year, the Young Adventure of the Year, the Environmentalist of the Year. And those awards are highly prized by the people who get them, which they should be. And so I'm very proud that Australian Geographic is still going and going well. I get stopped in the street quite often by people who work for Dick Smith Electronics, and their career started there. They were doing my Funway books and Funway kits. I was disappointed that Dick Smith closed. It was completely unnecessary. What happened there was the capitalism, Woolworths, took over the business from me, and I had 36 shops. I said to them, there's potential to have 100 shops in Australia selling to electronic enthusiasts. But the Woolworths board had pressure for endless expansion, endless growth, and they ended up opening 350 shops, which was ridiculous. And then they ended up being forced to sell low-margin items like TV sets and things like that, and kettles and electric kettles. And that just made the whole thing so it wasn't viable, too many shops. And so after 47 years, admittedly, it ran for about 27 years after I sold it, and ended up turning over billions of dollars a year, and the Woolworths shareholders made a lot of money out of it. So I was proud of that, but disappointed that it got closed down in the end.
And who are the people who inspire you?
It's interesting. I'm certainly inspired by people like Bill Gates, Andrew Forrest. I'm inspired by him because he's not only done well for himself and for his family, but he puts a lot back into society. He's a philanthropist. I'm disappointed that so few, when my last check, of the 100 billionaires we have in Australia, only 15 of them are known as philanthropists. That disappoints me. I believe there's an obligation that if you've done well, you've got to give back and do it openly. I just think that's just an obligation in a country like Australia. It's more accepted in the USA. If you're a billionaire in the USA, you're definitely going to be known as a philanthropist because it's just what you have to do. In Australia, we tend to allow most of our wealthy to be very selfish and greedy and not really give anything at all. Some of them tell me they do it secretly, but I've spoken to the major charities and they say, Dick, we don't get any large amounts anonymously. It just doesn't happen.
So what was your first job?
Right, my first job was I left school at 15 and it was an apprentice electrical fitter in a big factory that was making electrical high voltage switchgear. And it was the worst job I could ever imagine because by then at 15, I had quite a bit of knowledge of electronics. I'd been building radio sets and equipment. But this job, they used the apprentices to work on the production line doing process work. And I was bending springs. I had a big press, a hand press that I'd have to swing around backwards and forwards, completely monotonous day after day. And it was in a big tin roofed building, and it was in January, February, must have been 1959. And the heat was just staggering. It just an incredibly difficult job. And I only lasted at it about 2.5 weeks. And went back to my parents and said, look, I really don't like this job. Would I be able to go back to school and complete my leaving certificate? And they said yes, and we managed to get the school, North Sydney Technical High, to accept me coming back to school. So my first job was an apprentice, and it didn't last too long.
I guess it encouraged you to go back. If your job had been attractive, maybe you wouldn't have.
Exactly right. If the job had been good with me working on electronic parts, I probably would have not bothered to go back to school. And as it happens, it didn't really make any difference, because even though I went back to school and got my leaving certificate, I never completed any other training. So, you know, my only qualification really is my leaving certificate.
What's the best money advice you've ever received?
The best money advice I ever received was when I went to rent the second building for Dick Smith Electronics, and I had absolutely no money. And there was a chocolate factory at Gore Hill on the Pacific Highway. And I had a friend whose dad was quite wealthy. He was quite wealthy because he owned a GTO Pontiac, he owned an Alfa Romeo, he owned a speedboat, and he owned an aeroplane. Mm. And I thought, wow, he certainly knows what he's doing. And I've always learned to ask advice. And so I went to him and I said, look, I found this building on the Pacific Highway, but unfortunately it's $120 a week rent. And he said, oh, Dick, you should take it because there's so much more traffic going past. So I thought, well, I'd get him to come along with me to negotiate the lease. And when we were sitting there with the owner of the building, I agreed on $120 for a two-year lease. Suddenly, this person, Ray Jessup, said, oh, and of course, we'll want an option to purchase the building. And I looked at him with my mouth open and he said, oh, no, we certainly won't rent unless we have an option to purchase. And the owner of the building said, well, yes, I'll give you that, but it's $62,000 is the value of the building. Now, in those days in Sydney, a house cost about $30,000. I had all of $600 invested in my little taxi radio, two-way radio repair business. But we got the option to purchase. And the amazing thing was that within 2 years, I managed to raise the deposit, it was about $12,000, and go to a finance company and borrow the rest. And I bought that building or paid a deposit to pay it off. And from then on, whenever we opened up a Dick Smith building, a Dick Smith shop, I asked for an option to purchase. And of course, buying buildings in the 1960s and 70s, which I did, most people think my wealth has come from electronics and from publishing, but in fact most of my wealth has come from property ownership. And I remember when we sold eventually to Woolworths, I think I owned about a dozen buildings and or were paying them off, and I still own some of those buildings today, and they've been wonderful investments. So yes, the best advice was, if you lease some premises, try and get an option to purchase and then try and pay them off, because if the market's going up as it was in those days, you can't go wrong, and it's an easy way of making money. So I ended up making millions and millions of dollars from property, which I knew nothing about, but just purely because of that advice.
Wow. It's good that you went to ask advice, isn't it, I guess, at that time?
Yeah, that's one of my success forces. I have in my book, I write, I think it's, the book's an ideal book for someone thinking of opening a business, because I've listed my success forces. And the first one is ask advice. And the next one, surround yourself with capable people. And then the other one is copy the success of others. I tell people, if they want to start a business, get a cheap air ticket around the world and go and have a look what's happening in the USA and the UK, and then find out what's good and new and copy it and bring it back here, because that's what I did.
Yeah. Great ideas. So what's the best investment decision you've made?
Yeah, the best investment decision was to buy the Dick Smith Electronics building at North Ryde. I once again leased it, but with an option to purchase. And the option to purchase was $1.7 million. So I did buy it, or was paying it off. And I kept it for about, I think about 20 years, and sold it for $30 million. So I ended up making more money out of selling the head office of Dick Smith Electronics, and then I made out of selling Dick Smith Electronics the whole business. Wow. So that was probably my best investment decision, buying the Dick Smith building at North Ryde, which is still there. The reason the value went up so much is they put the underground railway underneath it and they put the station entrance right on my building. And I thought that was a bit of a nuisance, but then the council rezoned the building to a much higher ratio because they wanted to have a shopping centre at the station. So I did extremely well by complete luck.
What's the worst investment decision you've made?
The worst investment decision I ever made was investing in a small icebreaker. And that was the craziest thing I ever did, but I like to help adventurers. And Don McIntyre, who's a wonderful adventurer, he found this small icebreaker in Finland and he wanted to bring it back to Australia and then charter it to adventurers who wanted to go exploring in Antarctica. And when we were thinking of buying the icebreaker, there were lots of adventurers who were always wanting to charter boats to go to Antarctica. The problem was when we purchased the boat, I put in the money to buy it and Don McIntyre got it brought back to Hobart. And right at that time, there was just a complete lack of adventurers. And so the little icebreaker, instead of doing multiple trips to Antarctica, I think only did one. And I ended up, I think I lost $1 million on it. So that's my biggest loss in investment. But my suggestion to people is don't buy an icebreaker.
What's your favourite thing to splurge on?
Oh, I think my favourite thing to splurge on would be helicopters. Mm-hmm. At one stage, I owned three helicopters. I now only own one, but it's an Italian Augusta, AGUSTA. It's a beautiful, it's like a Ferrari of helicopters. It's the fastest civilian helicopter. It'll do about 150 knots, which is about 300 kilometres an hour. It's got retractable undercarriage. It's a beautiful machine that I fly myself. It's got two engines. But yes, I love helicopters, and if I splurge on anything, it'd be another helicopter. But I'm pretty happy with the one I've got.
Wow. No one's ever said that to me before. That's their splurge. If you had $10,000 right now, where would you invest it?
If I had $10,000 right now, I think I'd invest it in Woolworths or Wesfarmers, because people have to eat. I think we're going to have some tough times coming economically. Just don't believe you can have rising share markets the whole time, and you can't have endless growth. That's impossible. It's a finite world. So I'd be putting my money into Woolworths or Wesfarmers or someone like that, because even when times are tough, people are still going to have to eat. So I think the share value would probably remain and give you a small return.
What would you do if you only had $50 left in the bank?
If I only had $50 left in the bank, I'd go to some of my friends who I've helped over the years and say, now it's your turn to help me, and borrow some money from them.
Do you intend to leave an inheritance?
Yes, I intend to. I haven't signed the Bill Gates giving pledge because I'm not a billionaire, but my plan is to follow that, and that is that at least half the wealth of my wife and myself will be given to charity. We've had a meeting with our two daughters and they've agreed with that. And so we've got we have the Dick and Pip Smith Foundation, which gives about $1 million a year away. And it will, when we die, it will be funded to continue giving. And so that's good. So at least half of our money will go to charity when we die. And I think the Bill Gates giving pledge, is just the most wonderful thing. Every wealthy person should sign it, I believe. Basically, it says, you know, when you die, at least half of your, between now and when you die or when you die, at least half of your wealth will go to charity.
There's not enough of you around.
I do it because it makes me feel good.
Yeah.
You know, I like helping people because I consider it an obligation. I consider that it's an obligation if you've done well out of a country to put back and help people. It was part also of my Boy Scout training, where you had to, part of the Scout promise was to help other people at all times. And I've always had that feeling because it was given to me then when I was young.
And can you please finish the sentence, money makes...
Money makes the potential for people to be able to do worthwhile things for both themselves and for others.
Great. Thank you very much for that.
Oh, well, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day. You've been listening to The Remarkable Dick Smith. Please remember that you can subscribe to Friends with Money wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au.